So the figures are on the wiki. There will be some, so look over with someone when I ask for them. Okay. Okay, any questions from the previous lecture before we go on? Questions? Okay. Now, in yesterday's lecture, we ended up with the looking at the data on this quantity R, the ratio of E plus E minus to hadrons to E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus. And we saw that it had the feature, the general feature that we predicted of being flat in some regions. But then another feature that there were some narrow resonances to which E plus E minus coupled. And I made the statement yesterday that it was kind of obvious what was going on there. Those were the places where we couldn't treat quarks as being free and massless because they were bound into hadronic bound states. And so what I'd like to do is devote more or less the whole of this lecture to the study of the hadronic bound states of the heavy quarks, namely the charm quark C and the bottom quark B. So C-C bar states are called charmonium, and B-B bar states are called, well, there's not such a good name, bottomonium. Generically, these are called quarkonium. And today I'll tell you a little about what's known about quarkonium. And the main goal of the lecture is to convince you that quarks are just like electrons. So I've been trying to convince you that quarks are elementary spin-a-half fermions. And this is really the nicest test. My old professor, Kurt Gottfried, calls this system the hydrogen atom of the strong interactions. Actually, later he had to backtrack and call it the uranium atom of the strong interactions. But in any case, I hope that by the end of the lecture, the analogy between these systems and systems with electrons will be very clear. Now, the place to start is, I think, to understand a little better what the properties of systems with electrons are. And so if you would go to figures 2, the two most prominent atomic-like spectra made out of electrons are shown. On the one hand, hydrogen, which you guys know everything about. But I think it's worth spending a little time on the one on the right, positronium, which is to say the bound state of an electron and positron. Roughly, you make positrons, you get them very slow, you put them out in a gaseous medium, a positron will pick up an electron, it'll form a bound state. The bound state is relatively long-lived. We'll talk about its decay in a moment. Sometimes you can pick up a higher state in the spectrum and look at the atomic transitions. The spectrum is, of course, very much like hydrogen, with some important differences. But because this is a particle and an antiparticle, charge conjugation symmetry will also come in, play a role. And I guess I'd like to, because this is something that probably is not familiar to you, I'd like to review that so that we have some basis to talk about these states, which are also particle-antiparticle states, which are governed by charge conjugation. So first of all, you know that in hydrogen, all the energies are set by a constant called the Rydberg, which is 1/2. Now, in the units that I'm using in this course, 1/2 alpha squared, let's say mc squared, divided by n squared. So this is the very nice thing about hydrogen, which they probably don't tell you in undergraduate quantum mechanics. There are three scales. the mass mc squared of the particle, then down by a factor of 100 from that, alpha mc, which is basically 1 over the Bohr radius, and then the energies are alpha squared mc squared, and that gives you the Rydberg. Then there are even smaller scales for the fine structure and hyperfine structure. We'll get to that in a moment. Everything, though, there's only one dimensionful parameter, which is the mass of the electron. So everything must scale with that, except in hydrogen, the mass of the proton can come in. Okay, in positron, and then the Rydberg is this. The energy spectrum is minus the Rydberg times 1 over n squared. In positronium, we replace m with mu, the reduced mass, and the reduced mass for two equal mass particles to get the effective one-body problem is half the mass. So the Rydberg is half as large, all these distances are half as large as in hydrogen. Okay, now, what about the more detailed structure of the states? So, in hydrogen, very famously, there's a spin orbit splitting of the spin 3 halves p states from the spin a half p state. However, in positronium, it doesn't quite work that way. The two effects that you know from hydrogen are called fine structure and hyperfine structure. And fine structure is proportional to alpha squared times the Rydberg times some kind of spin orbit coupling. And hyperfine structure is alpha squared times the Rydberg times a spin dot spin coupling. And in hydrogen, the hyperfine comes with an extra power of 1 over the mass of the proton. But in positronium, these two effects are the same order of magnitude. And so you don't have the neat degeneracy of the S and P level, which is broken by famously by the Lamb shift, by radiative corrections. That's something you have in hydrogen, but you don't have it in positronium. So then you see the spectrum. The 1s state consists of two levels, one of which is the, so what's this notation? The principal quantum number, the spin, the L in SPD, et cetera, and then down here, the total J. So let me just write that up here. I'm going to use that notation throughout this lecture to denote which state I'm talking about. These states also have names in the charmonium and bottomonium system, and we'll discuss that as well. Okay. So in positronium, there's a 1s10 and a 1 triplet s1. So these are s states for which the total angular momentum comes from the spin, either anti-parallel or parallel. Now, these states have names that I'd like you to remember. This one is called parapositronium, and this one is called orthopositronium. And they're distinctly different, for reasons that I will discuss in a moment. Then, if I go up, and then every S state has a similar kind of breaking, where there's a lower para state and a higher ortho state, spin 0 and spin 1. Yes?
Are those then the singlet and triplets?
Yes, so this is the singlet, this is the triplet. So then if we go to 2p, and this is called 2p in positronium, but in the charm and bottom states, this is called the 1p for reasons that we'll discuss. But in any case, the first p state, there are two combinations. First of all, if we have a spin singlet, the orbital carries all of the angular momentum. And so there's a 2p1. And then if we have a spin triplet, we can have spin orbit coupling between the spin and the orbital motion. So it's a spin 1 plus a spin 1. So then there'll be three states, which are the 2p triplet, 0, 1, and 2 total angular momentum. And you see all those states on the level diagram that's on figure 2. And the transitions, radiative transitions among all of these states are observed in positronium. OK, now, which states can make transitions to which states depends on the fundamental symmetries of parity and charge conjugation, both of which are good symmetries of the electromagnetic interactions. So probably we should work out the parity and C quantum numbers of all of these states. For parity, the rule is the following. There's a minus 1 whenever you have an antiparticle. If you look at the parity symmetry of the Dirac equation, this is a fact about the Dirac equation. For the proof, go to the end of chapter 3 of my book. For particles, you assign parity plus 1. Antiparticles have a relative parity minus 1. This basically has to do with the fact that in the appropriate basis, gamma 0 has this structure. So you get this for particles and this for non-relativistic antiparticles. Okay. Then, if I interchange the particle and antiparticle, then I get a minus 1 to the L for the symmetry of the spatial wave function. And you folks should remember that parity doesn't change the spin direction. So parity doesn't act on the spin wave function. So these states have parity minus 1 times minus 1 to the L, which means these guys are both odd parity. These guys here will be even parity, and so on. OK, and we saw this in the first lecture. Quark-antiquark states, the lowest quark-antiquark states have odd parity. And you see that that's just their particle-antiparticle nature. OK, another interesting symmetry is charge conjugation. Now, charge conjugation basically is a symmetry that replaces the A operator, let's say, with spin up. It interchanges that with the B operator with spin up, and similarly with spin down. And this, you can show, is a symmetry of the strong interactions and, here, of quantum electrodynamics. So the C parity of one of these positronium states is the following. First of all, there's a minus 1, because if you interchange A and B, then you're interchanging two operators that anti-commute with each other. When you put them back in the right order, you get a minus sign. Secondly, because the momentum of the bound state is the vector in the bound state is the vector from the antiparticle to the particle, you get a minus 1 to the L from the spatial wave function. And finally, you have to look at the spin wave function, because you're interchanging the particles that carry the spin. If there's a symmetric spin wave function, you get 1. If there's an anti-symmetric spin wave function, you get 0. So this is spin triplet and spin singlet. And then if you multiply those minus signs together, you get the C. Yes?
Why would A and B anti-commute?
Because they're Fourier modes of the Dirac field. The Dirac field is anti-commute. So this has to do with the Fermi statistics of electrons and positrons.
What is the definition of what is A and what is B?
Oh, I'm sorry. A is the creation operator for an electron, and B is the creation operator for a positron. And you folks remember that AK, BP, anti-commutate, is equal to 0. OK, so let's now look at the C parity of these states. Interestingly, because of this last factor, it's opposite in these two cases. It's C equals plus for orthopositronium. This is the antisymmetric spin wave function times that factor. And C equals minus for, C equals plus for parapositronium. And C equals minus for orthopositronium. Similarly, over here, let's see if I can get this right. C equals plus for these guys, and C equals minus for this one. Okay. Now, it's somewhat, it's very interesting that the difference in C between these two states is directly manifested in their decays. The photon, one thing that C does is that it reverses the sign of charges, so it reverses the electric field. So the photon has negative C. So that means that according to C, so these states are all unstable, because eventually the particle will annihilate the antiparticle, and it all disappears into photons. However, for the para case, 1s10, this occurs in the simplest way, where you go to two photons, C equals plus, C equals plus. However, by C, the ortho form is forbidden from decaying to two photons. It must go to three photons. So basically, if you compute the Feynman diagrams, for this guy to go to two photons, everything will cancel. And then you have to go to one higher order in perturbation theory in order to get a decay. And this is reflected in the decay rates for parapositronium. The decay rate is 1/2 alpha to the fifth times m c squared or whatever. The lifetime is 1.2 times 10 to the minus 10 seconds. For ortho, the lifetime is, I'll write the formula because it's interesting, 2 over 9 pi alpha to the sixth mc squared. And then there's a funny factor when you do the integrals of pi squared minus 9. So there's an extra suppression that no one really understands when you do the integrals. And the answer here is 1.4 times 10 to the minus 7 seconds. So when you make positronium, there's this very odd feature that a quarter of them decay like that, and then the other three quarters hang around for three orders of magnitude longer. Okay. An interesting statement, and one that will be relevant before the end of the lecture. Okay, so now you know about positronium. So now, what you would hope, what I would hope, is that if you made any other, so, and in working this out, I've only used the very general properties of particle antiparticle systems. Spin 1/2, conservation of P, and conservation of C. So what you would expect is that these same ideas would apply directly if I have any particle-antiparticle system made of fundamental fermions. So if that's what quarks are, it should apply. And so let's see. So what I'd like to do now is to think about how you produce these states in E plus E minus annihilation. So we're going to have E plus E minus annihilation through a single virtual photon to a state which is going to be a bound state of Q and Q bar. Now, if you look at the spectrum, you'll immediately see that only certain states are available. The virtual photon here has J equals 1, as we discussed last time. It has odd parity. And it has odd C because it consists of a single photon. So, and the particle and antiparticle originate from a point where the pair is produced. So there's only one class of states one can actually produce directly in E plus E minus annihilation, this one here, the triplet S1 states. In principle, we could produce the whole spectrum of them, but only the radially excited states, because we're producing the quark and the antiquark from a point. I should say that when you add relativistic corrections, there are some modifications of this. You can produce other states at relatively small rates. But the dominant effect is going to be the spectrum of triplet S1 states, ortho-charmonium or ortho-bottomonium. It would probably be good if I derived that for you explicitly. So I'd like to waste a little of your time doing a computation of the rate at which these particles are produced. And you'll see how it all comes out. But first, you have a question.
Oh, maybe this is exactly what you're saying then, but
I don't quite understand the argument about why
It can't be produced at a point. Well, it has the wrong C. So it can be produced at a point, but it can't be produced from this Feynman diagram.
Oh.
Okay. So maybe it would be good if I just did a computation, and then you'll see explicitly how it works. So let's do that. So we've developed a lot of the technology yesterday, so I just have to apply that. So once again, I want to use this matrix element, minus IE, plus IQF, F is the flavor of the heavy meson, U bar gamma mu V, minus I over S, V bar gamma mu U. From the previous lecture, I'm looking at this diagram. The V bar gamma mu U of the incoming electron, again, ignoring the overall sign, which won't make any difference, is 2E, or the square root of S, times root 2 times either epsilon L or epsilon R, depending on the polarization state. So now, what I'd like to do is to calculate this matrix element in the other limit, the limit of non-relativistic motion for the heavy quarks, because we're interested in a bound state in which the heavy quarks are moving non-relativistically. And this is actually pretty simple. For extreme non-relativistic motion, things are at rest. In the conventions that I used last time, the U's and V's look like this. And Xi is a spinner. And maybe I should say Xi here is the spin of the particle. And Xi over here is the flipped spinner. That is the spinner of the particle that when I eject it, I get the hole, which is the antiparticle. And so then if you just kind of multiply everything out, you find that V bar gamma mu U is equal to, it'll be something like this. It'll be, So this is, again, V dagger and then sigma U. And now please notice what's happening here. When I multiply out this level of the Dirac matrices, I'll get 1 times in here, 1 times 1, 1, 1, and minus 1. So the time component will actually be 0. Then when I multiply out the space parts, there's an extra minus sign in here. So what I'll get is finally minus m sandwiched between these u and v spinners. There'll be a sigma. And that'll be the answer. Okay. So now what we need to do, and maybe I should just say, if I dot this guy into this guy, I'm going to get a raising and lowering, a raising or lowering sigma. So if I write out the whole matrix element now, we can pretty much do that. IQF E squared, that square root of 2 that was hanging around, square root of S, and M, there's an S there. Okay, now I'm going to get C dagger sigma C, so this is the for the Q bar and for the Q. And then when I dot this guy into that vector, I'm going to get sigma dot epsilon. I probably dropped a minus sign, but it's not going to be important. Sigma dot epsilon LR. So this thing here is the square root of 2 times sigma plus, or the square root of 2 times sigma minus, depending on whether it's L or R. There's some polarization things here that you could keep track of. I'm not going to bother today. OK, now let's compute, first of all, the inverse process to the one I was talking about, the bound state going to E plus E minus. So there, I need to know what is the wave function of this bound state, so I can use that as the initial state matrix element to evaluate this S matrix element. So let's write that bound state in the following way. Obviously, it has the following structure. D3k over 2 pi cubed, a spatial wave function psi of k, a spin wave function sigma ab. And then we have the state with a quark at momentum k and spin, or let's write the anti-quark with momentum, let's put it down here. The anti-quark with momentum minus k and spin a, and the quark with momentum k and spin b. And now I just have to do one more thing. This is the expression that's correctly normalized in your conventional non-relativistic normalization. If I correct to the relativistic normalization that I've been using in quantum field theory, there's a square root of 2m that goes here, and we need a square root of 2 times the mass of the bound state that goes here to get this in the correct relativistic normalization. Okay, well, excuse me, it's December in Canada. Sorry. Okay. And then what are we supposed to put for sigma? Well, for sigma here, we're going to put the following thing. For a spin singlet state, we want to put 1. And for a spin triplet state, we want to put n dot sigma. And there's one more thing that I left out, which is the color. Quarks, as we saw, come in 3 colors. And so we'd better put a delta function in color, so because this is supposed to be a color singlet state, like all mesons. And then you need a 1 over the square root of 3 to normalize that. OK. So this expression now is a, hopefully physically, you understand that it's physically correct, but it's also a correctly normalized bound state wave function. OK. Now, what you see is that this guy here replaces the C's up here when we evaluate this formula. So if we evaluate the matrix element for a bound state to go to E plus E minus, this is going to be proportional to the trace of sigma down here with the structure sigma dot epsilon up top. And that is explicitly equal to zero for the spin singlet and n dot epsilon times 2. Oh, sorry. Now it's correct and normalized. N dot epsilon times the square root of 2 for a spin triplet. So if you actually work out explicitly what the matrix element is, you find the same rule that I derived to you using the fundamental symmetries, that you get 0 for the spin 1 state because the E plus E minus matrix element requires a you get 0 for the spin 0 state because this is requiring a relative spin of the quark and antiquark. And for the spin triplet state, it's not a spin 1, it's a spin singlet, or S equals 0. And this is a spin triplet, S equals 1. For that state, you'll get some non-zero matrix on. And then, well, what can I say? Evaluate this. Maybe I shouldn't be spending a lot more time on this, although we're almost there. If you now, let me, please excuse me, I'm going to just now write the answer for this matrix element. And then we'll see that all the ingredients are there, and you folks can verify all the factors from the notes. The final answer that you get is 2i e squared qf. There's a normalization factor, which is the square root of 2 over m. When you square this guy, you get a factor of the square root of 3. That is 3 from the trace of this, and then 1 over the square root of 3. You get the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed psi of k. And this you recognize, so psi is the momentum space wave function. So this you recognize as the spatial wave function at r equals 0. And now let me just tell you the thing that I told you before. If you take into account relativistic corrections, you'll get some k squareds in this expression. And those will allow, these will give you psi prime at r equals 0. So that'll allow some of the p states, but not all of them, also to be produced. But highly suppressed, basically with powers of v over c. And then finally, an n dot epsilon. And now what we can do is just square that. So I hope that all the, let me just ask you, all the features are correct. And the only question is whether I got this factor of the square root of 2 right. And as I say, you can verify that in the notes. Any questions other than that? OK. So we'll take the square of the matrix element, 3 times 8 times e to the fourth times qf squared divided by m psi of 0, the wave function at the origin, n dot epsilon. If I want to know the rate for the bound state going to e plus e minus, I would then use the following formula. 1 over 2m, the integral over phase space, which is 8 pi. These are massless particles in the final state. And then the square of the matrix element, averaged over the polarization of the bound state and summed over the polarizations of the e plus e minus. So that would be this expression here, 8 times 3 over m qf squared. Sorry, this should be psi squared. Then the average of n dot epsilon will be 1/3. And n dot epsilon. And then I sum over n with a 1/3. And then I have to sum over both left and right, so there's a factor of 2. So this factor here will be 2/3. And so the final answer when the smoke clears is 16 pi alpha squared over m squared, the wave function at the origin, and qf squared. Actually, let me write a bunch of formulae associated with this. And probably, because the hour is short, I'll ask you to relate them. Yes?
I should ask this ages ago, but when you're talking about, you keep talking about the wave function at the origin, do you mean the field, or do you actually mean a wave function?
Oh, no. Please look at the, oh God, I've started erasing things. So what we have is a Q and a Q bar, and it's a bound state, so they have a Schrodinger wave function. So that Schrodinger wave function, looks like this in space, and it's the wave function that tells you the distance apart the Q and the Q bar are. So we can write that as a Schrodinger wave function psi of r, or we could work in Fourier space, and we could work with the Schrodinger wave function psi of k, and they're dual to each other. And the relation is that psi of r is equal to the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed e to the ik dot r psi of k. So when you work with Feynman diagrams, this is the easiest one, because typically you're in momentum space. But if you want to think about it physically, you probably want to go over here, because you're used to thinking about hydrogen atom wave functions. And so that's what I did. I worked out this formula in terms of k space. I then noticed that this object here is actually the physical wave function at the origin of the bound state. Okay? And then I'm just going to use that in my formulae, because that's something you know how to think about. If you can visualize the bound state, you can see how high it is at the origin. In particular, for a p state, that's zero, so you're not going to get anything. Okay? Okay, so let me then, as a summary of everything that's here, write the following formulae. First of all, the rate at which the bound state decays to e plus e minus. So now this is specifically an n triplet S1 state is, as I said before, 16 pi alpha squared over m, the wave function at the origin, and the quark charge squared. Another thing you could work out is that you could take the same matrix element and use it to compute the rate at which e plus e minus is produced in the bound state. So when you do that computation, you get a one-body phase space. Now, one-body phase space is actually very simple. It's the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed. We're producing the bound state, so you get the energy. In the rest frame, you would have the mass of the bound state here, in general, the energy of the bound state. And then you have 2 pi to the fourth times a delta function of the incoming energies, k1 plus k2 minus k. Now, we can rewrite that as the integral d4k over 2 pi cubed times 2 pi delta function of k squared minus m squared. So if I do the delta function integration, I'll get back this relativistic phase space. And then we've got the 2 pi to the fourth times k1 plus k2, the energy momentum conserving delta function. Now, finally, let's do the d4k integral on that delta function. And what's left is something like this, delta of s minus m squared. And that tells you that there's a peak at the bound state position. So using that logic, one can then write the following formula, 192 pi cubed alpha squared, the wave function at the origin squared, divided by m cubed times delta of s minus m squared. So this gives you basically the integral of the cross section across the peak. Of course, if there's a lifetime, the peak will be broadened a little. And then finally, I should just note that there's some general principle that leads to these equations. So if you just put in an arbitrary matrix element, you'll get a relation between these quantities. And the general relation is that this is equal to 4 pi squared psi squared of 0 divided by m cubed. The general relation is this. There's a 2j plus 1 here, and m, a gamma of x going to e plus e minus, and a delta function of s minus m squared. So what have we learned here? What we've learned is that there's actually a lot of information, even in just the raw measurement of the, so each of these peaks is a peak with a width which is related to, which is h bar over the total lifetime of the particle. The integral over that peak contains the information which is in these equations. It contains the quark charge, and it contains the value of the wave function at the origin. And then you can make an explicit bound state model and ask whether those things make sense. Yes?
The cross section goes to bound state.
Mm-hmm.
Is that done at first order?
This is just done at the lowest order. Okay. In,
so you can't take like a third order width and then expect to get the third order?
Well, if the width occurs for the first time in third order, it's for the first non-zero coefficient. So if the width occurs for the first time in 15th order, this will be correct.
But you wouldn't be able to do it correctly.
However, it wouldn't be correct for the radiative correction. Okay. Good. So now we should talk a little about the phenomenology associated with these things. So certainly one of the biggest events in my life in high energy physics was in November 1974 when two announcements came very quickly to all physics departments around the world. First, that an electron-positron ring at Stanford had discovered an enormous resonance in E plus E minus at the energy of 3.1 GeV. And second, that the group of Sam Ting at Brookhaven had actually been sitting on the information that they had observed the reverse process. So at the SPEAR accelerator at Stanford, they observed E plus E minus to a resonance. And at Brookhaven, they observed the reverse process, that in PP reactions, where E plus E minus pairs came out, these E plus E minus pairs were resonant with a really dramatic resonance, and at the same place, at 3.1 GeV. So needless to say, the following things happened, that the leaders of these experiments, Bert Richter and Sam Ting, won the Nobel Prize. And of course, they couldn't agree on the name. So this is called the J, this is called the Psi, and this particle is referred to in all books as J-Psi. So now, in SPEAR, they were able to adjust the energy of E plus E minus, and they discovered a second one at, so this is now the Psi, I think, I have the number here. They discovered a second one at 3690 MeV, and then later investigation found a couple more. I think on the next couple figures, you see the discovery figures for the psi. And then if you just turn the page, you'll see the corresponding thing for the bottomonium resonance, the upsilon. So these things we now consider to be CC bar, one triplet S, one, and the two triplet S1 bound states. For BB bar, again, the primary discovery, the original discovery, was in a reaction like this, PP to mu plus mu minus, with the mu plus mu minus forming a resonance at a certain place. However, later at Cornell, people build an electron-positron ring and scan very carefully. And I think if you go to page 4 of the slides, you'll see all of the upsilon resonances. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So one really now has seen a lot of these triplet S1 resonances appearing as resonances in E plus E minus. Okay, we'll talk about the other states in a moment, but let me just say that this information gives a lot of information to try and figure out the following question. Quarks are not bound primarily by electromagnetism. Primarily, they're bound by the strong interactions. And so the question is, what is the binding potential? You know, is it a Coulomb potential? Is it something of a different shape? Well, from all this data, you could just do the inverse scattering problem and try and figure it out. And so then when these results were found, lots of people tried to model what is the potential that binds non-relativistic quarks and anti-quarks. Well, intuitively, you would think that that potential has to have the following form. It might or might not look like a Coulomb potential at short distances. Actually, in the theory that we'll develop of the strong interactions next week, that potential is Coulombic at very small distances. However, at large distances, it has to reflect the fact that quarks can't get out of mesons. And so it's got to be increasing and certainly larger than the Coulomb potential at large distances. So roughly, that potential would look like that. My professors at Cornell modeled it by Coulomb plus linear, thinking that this part would come from a relativistic string. There are lots of other models. I think on the next page in the figure, what you see is about 5 models that have appeared in the literature. And the models all agree in a certain region. And then it's obvious why they agree, because that's where the charmonium and bottomonium states are. So that's the data that you're fitting. But there's a qualitative implication of this shape of the potential, which is very important. So let's go back to hydrogen. For hydrogen, the 2p and the 2s states are exactly degenerate up to radiative corrections. But if you think about what hydrogen atom wave functions look like, the 2p wave function has its nodes in the angular direction, and it's relatively small in the radial direction, whereas the 2s wave function has its node in the radial direction, so it sticks out farther. Right? So that means that if you increase the potential at large distances, you'll break the degeneracy between 2p and 2s, and you'll push the 2s up above the 2p. So just this qualitative picture tells you that the spectrum of charmonium should look something like this. We already know there's the 3.1 and the 3.7, which would be the 1s and 2s. And then the 2p must lie below them. And so now I'm going to start calling it the 1p. These guys, the states we produce, have odd charge conjugation. This has even charge conjugation, or at least some of these guys have even charge conjugation. And so then we would expect radiative transitions like that. And so there's an obvious thing to do. You sit on this resonance, you look for gamma rays, and you ask whether you can find these states. And now let me just draw this in a little more detail. Just like in positronium, the C equals plus states, there are actually three, with J equals 0, 1, and 2. And then there's another C equals minus state with J equals 1, which is, however, has the wrong C to be accessed by radiative transitions. Okay, so this is just what I told you about positronium. So the expectation is that from the 2s state, there are radiative transitions down and three distinct transitions that access these three states. And then these have the correct C to come down and end up in the J psi. And so if you then look for events where the J psi has a recognizable decay, like the decay back to two muons, and there are two photons in the event, you might be able to see these things. So the discovery plot is on the next slide. And it's very cool, actually. So there are two photons, so you have to figure out which one is which. It turns out that this distance is smaller than that one, so the lower energy photons turn out to be these. If you look at the plot, there's a quite interesting feature that the spots, there are three distinct spots, and they're broadened in this direction. So these three energies correspond to the three photon energies to go from here to here. Then, when these guys are made, they recoil against the photon. So there's Doppler broadening of the second transition, and that makes the smear in this direction. So it's not very high statistics, but they really had it nailed just from this observation. Three states, just as you have in positronium, if you look at the Clebsch-Gordonology of the transitions from here to here, you can actually verify the three spins being 0, 1, and 2. Okay, now please turn the page. On the next page, there is a later experiment called the crystal ball experiment, also done at the Spear Ring at SLAC. The crystal ball is a ball about that big of sodium iodide. So it's one of these crystal electromagnetic calorimeters that are extremely precise. And on that slide, you'll see, and then this is the inclusive photon spectrum, the energies of all photons. And on that slide, you will see eight transitions, which I believe correspond to these three. The transition from here to the here to the one singlet S0 state. So these are electric dipole transitions in the notation of atomic physics. This is a magnetic dipole transition. And also the transition to the 2 S10 state. This is called the A to C and the A to C prime. So in that one picture, you see essentially as much about the charm, anti-charm physics as we know about positronium physics. Okay? Well, how's that? If you turn the slide once more, you'll see an analogous picture from the Upsilon system. All these things have also been observed in the BB bar system. And so there you see essentially these three levels in a photon spectrum taken at the Upsilon. Okay. Well, now, there's one more. Oh, and then I think if you go to figures 9 and 10, I put there from a recent review the full set of states that are known in both of these systems. So actually, today, we know more states in these systems than we know in positronium. Okay. So now there's a very important problem that we have to discuss. And I'm going to take a little more of your I'm going to take another 10 minutes, probably, to discuss this. And that is, okay, these states are there, but why are they so long-lived? So why is it that the quarks and the anti-quarks in these states don't just annihilate, but they're strongly interacting after all? Why don't they just annihilate and turn into other strongly interacting particles? So for light quarks, we saw the, remember, in this diagram, the rho, omega, and phi. If, when you looked at this, you saw a broad resonance, which is called the rho prime. But then you didn't see any other distinct resonances of light quarks. And basically, the reason for this is that the higher resonances of light quarks just fall apart into other states of light quarks, eventually into multipions. So what we think is that the, you know, 5, 6, 7, 15, okay, the quarks are permanently bound. So all these states have to exist. But they have very short lifetimes, and so they're very broad resonances. And so they're broad and they overlap, and they can't be distinguished. And by the time you get to 3 GeV, a typical strong interaction resonance at 3 GeV will have a width, a very short lifetime, a width of 300 or 400 MeV, and it's just overlapping all of its neighbors, and it's not distinguishable. Now we come to the psi, and let me write these numbers, which are quite remarkable. The width of the psi of the J-psi is 93 keV. The width of the upsilon, the lowest BB bar state, is 54 keV. So this is supposed to be the strong interactions. How could these numbers possibly be so small? There's a little piece of data that gives a clue about this, which is that the width of the eta C, that is to say this state, the triplet S1 state, is larger. It's 27 MeV. It's still incredibly small compared to expectations, but it's larger than this one. Now, this, if you were paying attention in the first 10 minutes of the lecture, should certainly remind you of something that I said then. Because this is paratermonium, and this is orthotermonium. And so if these were photon decays, this would be a 2-photon decay, and this would be a 3-photon decay. So we'd have to go to one higher order in perturbation theory in order to make this decay. Now, this probably makes no sense, because we're talking about the strong interactions. Nevertheless, I'd just like to pursue this model a little. If the fundamental quantum of the strong interaction is a vector particle like the photon with odd C like the photon, and if it's weakly coupled, well, of course, that's odd, but let me make that assumption, then I can calculate these decay rates, and I can see if the formulae makes sense. Now, I'm going to now write down some answers for those decay rates. Now, I warn you that these answers are the first term of a perturbation series for which people have computed the second term. The second term is often as big as the first term. So these are not perturbation series that converge well. But the formulae are just indicative. But if you just, to lowest order in this model, compute the rates of decay for the singlet S0 and for the triplet S1, and I'm going to call these vector particles gluons. This one can decay to 2 gluons, and this one can decay to 3 gluons. And the rates that you get when you do the computation are 8 pi over 3, alpha S cubed, so this is the analog of alpha for this gluon that I've put in, psi squared over the mass of the quark, and in this case, 40 over 81, that funny factor of pi squared minus 9, please excuse me, alpha s cubed, the wave function at the origin divided by the mass of the quark. Now, if this is the, these are both 1s states, so this factor here should be identical in the two cases. Oh, by the way, these numbers include some group theory factors, because which apply to the real theory of strong interactions. So if you did this in quantum electrodynamics-like model, you'd get a different coefficient, but all the other structures would be the same. In particular, this pi squared minus 9 is a suppression. And that's the same suppression that we saw before in the ortho-positronium decay. So if you actually put in numbers, you can see that this coefficient's larger than that one. This is a less than 1. So you actually get a lot of just numerical suppression between here and here. And then a number like alpha s of 0.1, something like that, will explain that ratio. Now, alpha s of 0.1 is a small number. Maybe it's odd that the strong interactions are weak in this particular example, but it does lead you in a direction that explains the data. Somehow, even though when the quarks get out to large distances, they're strongly interacting and they're confined, in the annihilation, it happens at very small distances when they're very close together, touching, basically. The annihilation involves a large momentum transfer, namely a momentum comparable to the heavy quark mass has to be transferred from one side to the other. And in that case, it seems, it's sensible, according to the data, to think about that process as being composed of a weak coupling with a coupling here, G sub s, so that alpha s equals G sub s squared over 4 pi is a relatively small number. Let me give you one more example of this. I computed already in this class the triplet S1 to E plus E minus rate. When you put in the 2/3 charge of the charm quark, which was needed last time to get the right cross section, you get 4 pi alpha squared. Oh, sorry. Well, sorry. What you get is 4 pi alpha squared Q F squared psi squared of 0 over M Q squared. So one thing different that you can do is you can compare this rate to the rate for E plus E minus, which, as I already explained to you, is related to the rate for producing the psi in the first place. The value here is quite well known. It's 5.6 keV. So it's a number that's comparable to, a little comparable to that number. And so then if you work it through, the J psi to 3 gluon rate divided by the J psi to E plus E minus rate is supposed to be 5/18, again, pi squared minus 9 over pi, alpha s cubed over alpha squared. And here, you need a somewhat different value of alpha s. This has to be less than 0.1 to explain this. And the measured numbers, you need alpha s of 0.2. These aren't really inconsistent with each other. I told you these perturbation expansions converge rather badly. And here you're taking the cube root of something. But nevertheless, it's another indication that one needs a relatively weak coupling in these decays of heavy quarks into gluons to explain the data on why the width should be so small. So this is an interesting theme to carry away. And so now we've met this already in two contexts. First of all, in the context that when you produce quark antiquark in E plus E minus, they form narrow jets, which means there can be lots of particle production, but there's no large momentum transfer. There's a suppression of large momentum transfer. Here we see there's a suppression of large momentum transfer in annihilation. In the next lecture, we'll see another example of the suppression of large momentum transfer. So maybe this is telling us something. And then Monday, I'll try and explain how this could possibly be correct. So enough for today.
Small to like
Right.
So they're.
So that's just purely electromagnetic.
Right.
So that width, we know why it's small.
Yeah.
You get about the right answer if you make a potential model and you put in the wave function at the origin and a mass of, let's say, 1.5 GeV for the charm part.
Right, and so most of them,
so the
large wave resonances would come.